Well, thank you both very much for an outstanding presentation and introduction to the details of bankruptcy. I'm sure you've answered a number of the questions folks may have come in with, but we also have a number that folks have started sending in here to put to you for further clarification. The first of which is, how do I know, if I'm looking for a competent attorney to help in restructuring or launching into bankruptcy, how do I know I'm talking to a competent attorney when I contact someone to begin the process?
This is Ken. I think that the question I would ask is, ask the attorney, would be, what experience do you have in agricultural bankruptcy? How many have you filed, recently filed cases similar to mine? Have you achieved confirmation? I mean, any attorney can file a Chapter 12 case. It's easy to file the case. The hard part is getting the plan confirmed, and that is the goal of the producer. I mean, if you're a producer and you hire an attorney and file a case and it ends up not being confirmed, then you've spent money and resources and you haven't achieved your goal. So I think the first question would be, what experience do you have in this area of agricultural bankruptcy? There's nothing, I think that's the first thing that I would do.
If I can just add something, there are a number of attorneys, for example, in the state of Colorado that have, that I've worked with that have filed Chapter 12s, and the vast majority of them have been quite successful. So, you know, contacting possibly a farm management specialist who's worked in the Chapter 12 area may have some names for you to talk to in terms of qualified attorneys.
Okay, good thoughts. I've had another question come in now. I was wondering about how mediation fits into the picture. How does a person or farmer or rancher know whether or not they should try bankruptcy, try mediation, or maybe some other workout solution? What are some of the trade-offs between those different alternatives?
This is Ken. I would say that that if you have, my experience has been that if you have a small number of disputes, like let's say that you're current on your trade debt, you're current on your say you're current on your payments to John Deere on your equipment, but you're not current and having problems with one lender, you're just having problems with one lender, so it's a fairly isolated situation, that in that case mediation is a good idea. I think it's good that you explore that. In cases where the producer has multiple problems, you're in default and there's a foreclosure filed by the one lender, there's another legal action filed by a second lender, you're behind on your payroll taxes or on some sort of a tax obligation, you're behind on your trade debt, you owe the co-op money, you know, you've got multiple problems, then it's hard to mediate all of those different things. One good thing about Chapter 12 is it takes kind of an overall approach. In other words, the goal of Chapter 12 is that when you're done and you have your plan confirmed, you then have a new, it's like you have a new mortgage with all of your different creditors. The other thing I'd like to point out is that in the Chapter 12 case, if you're unable to mediate out your issues before filing the Chapter 12, in the Chapter 12 case, in almost every situation, the judge is going to encourage the parties to mediate. It doesn't mean you go meet with a mediator, but it's going to encourage you to negotiate and try and iron out your differences. I've had judges tell me on a number of occasions that, you know, I want you attorneys to go and sit down and, you know, just make a good faith effort to try and iron out these differences, and bring me a plan that we can all agree on. Because if you bring the judge a plan that everyone can agree on, then you don't need the confirmation hearing, and it makes things go much more smoothly. So anyway, I think you, in some cases, mediation before filing is a good idea. I don't think it works when there's just a numerous defaults on all different classes of creditors.
If I can just add a comment to that too, I think that if most farmers and ranchers or dairymen, whatever, are having financial difficulties, if they're proactive, if they're working with a lender to work out of them, then mediation tends to be a more feasible solution. But if they've let the payment dates come and pass, and of course the lenders have fewer options available or alternatives available to them. So having a good relationship with your lender is incredibly important, because it certainly is going to help you through if you end up filing a Chapter 12, and there may be situations where you're able to restructure without the need to file a Chapter 12. But each situation is unique. I don't think Ken, you and I have done a Chapter 12 that the two of them are alike. They're all going to be different. Okay?
Well, thank you for those comments. That really helps to kind of clarify things, I think. There's also another question now come wondering about the differences with bankruptcy laws. I mean, presume most of the things you gentlemen have talked about this morning are particularly regarding the federal law, but are there also state-specific laws that govern some aspects of bankruptcy within particular states?
This is Ken, and the bankruptcy is totally a federal legal proceeding. So if you file a Chapter 12 in Colorado, it's filed in Denver. You don't file in your county or your local district court. It's a federal proceeding. The vast majority of the bankruptcy laws are contained in the Bankruptcy Code, which is a federal code. There's just very little state law that figures in to the Bankruptcy Code. Now, having said that, there are sometimes, once in a while, we'll have a situation where the bankruptcy judge will look at state law for guidance in making a decision. But the Bankruptcy Code is a federal law.
Okay, that helps quite a bit. Another question is kind of along the line of the big picture again. There's certainly risk associated with most of the decisions made by managers involved in commercial agriculture. I'm wondering, what are some of the risks that are involved in the decision to use bankruptcy to resolve a current set of financial problems? Or maybe another way to put it is, what are some of the consequences or some of the things that a manager ought to be looking for with bankruptcy versus, you know, say some other alternative action that they might take?
I would say that the many of the people that we work with have tried all of the other alternatives, and they're down to the decision of, do I file bankruptcy under Chapter 12 and try and reorganize, or do I just turn everything back over to the bank? I mean, that a lot of times it comes down to that. So those are your two choices. Now, that's assuming that you've tried to mediate and be proactive and work with your creditors. The disadvantages of filing the Chapter 12, the possible disadvantages would be, first of all, if your plan is not confirmed, then you've spent some money and some time and some energy trying to do something, and it didn't work. That would be one disadvantage. The second disadvantage is that it obviously, if you file any type of a bankruptcy, or if you're involved in a foreclosure or any legal proceeding, it's going to be a negative mark on your credit report. So those, I think, are the two disadvantages of filing the Chapter 12. But again, most people don't file it unless they just have no other alternative other than to just liquidate.
Okay. Another member of our audience has asked if you have any particular perspective on bankruptcy, sort of thinking from the lender standpoint. Are there some insights that you might share, thinking or coming at it from that perspective as to the ins and outs of bankruptcy?
The lenders, and this is, of course, just as a general rule, the lenders, obviously, they don't like the bankruptcy, because when the bank examiners come and see that one of their customers has filed bankruptcy, it causes problems for the bank with the bank examiners to some extent. In other words, the loans may have to be reclassified and devalued, and there's negative consequences for the lender there. The lenders sometimes are cooperative in the Chapter 12 cases, and by cooperative I mean they'll try and negotiate out an agreement. In some cases, the lenders just kind of take a no prisoners approach, and their attitude is that we don't think this reorganization is going to work. So it varies a lot from lender to lender and from case to case.
If I can just add a comment, in a personal experience, not working with Ken, but with another attorney related to Chapter 12, there was an extremely bad relationship, personal relationship, between the creditor and the debtor. And the legal fees that were charged in that case were phenomenal relative to even the level of debt that was in existence. So that's sort of an impetus, for my opinion, for farmers to make sure that they maintain a really good relationship with their lenders, so we don't get into these contests where personalities start to play a role. So that can get very costly. Now, you're not maybe one out of 1,000 you're going to run into those deals, but that can create some real problems trying to get a Chapter 12 approved.
Yeah, it certainly creates challenges that a person would prefer to avoid. So thank you for those comments. Another question's come in here. Person's wondering about, most farms who are eligible for Chapter 12 will likely have debt that's both personal debt and debt of the farm itself, especially with the prevalence of credit card financing that a lot of people are using for both business and personal financing in current times. So they're wondering, how is it that these two sources of debt are going to be handled by the court in workouts for a farm family situation?
This is Ken, and I would say, first of all, that I'm assuming that this person or this family is eligible for Chapter 12. But if you're eligible for Chapter 12, the personal debts and the farm debts are addressed in the same proceeding. They're addressed in the same reorganization plan. And so if you have, let's say that the wife is a school teacher in town and she's buying a Honda on payments, those Honda payments on her car, even though it's not related to the agricultural part of the business, the payments on that car are addressed in the Chapter 12 plan, right along with the farm and ranch obligations.
Okay. We've had another member of our audience ask a question about the overall bill for legal fees. Does that usually relate to the size of the bankruptcy itself and the total settlement, or is it charged out on a billable hour basis for the attorneys that are involved?
It's billed out on an hourly basis. Normally, the normal procedure is that the attorney and the client agree on a retainer that needs to be paid before the case is filed. There's a lot of the legal work that needs to be done in these cases is done prior to filing. There's a lot of schedules and forms and motions and paperwork that needs to be prepared before the case is even filed. So a retainer is paid. The amount of the retainer is negotiated or discussed with the attorney and the client, and that retainer is then put into a trust account. As the attorney does work on the case, he pulls money out of the trust account. Now, usually these attorney fees have to be approved by the Chapter 12 judge. So the attorney submits his bill that shows what work he did and how much time he spent on that work to the judge, and then the judge will either approve or disapprove those legal fees. And then once they're approved, that money will come out of that retainer to pay the attorney fees. So that's how that's done. Now, if the retainer, if the money in the retainer runs out during the case, then that presents a situation where either another retainer needs to be paid or payments need to be set up for the attorney as part of the Chapter 12 plan. But hourly rate attorney fees is the primary way that attorneys are compensated.
And likewise, the farm management expert would also have to be approved by the court.
Yeah.
And his fees, and usually his fees are not paid until after the 12 is approved, or unless it's converted to a 7, then he results in the unsecured pile like the rest of us. So both cases has to be approved by the court.
Yeah, and keep in mind that anyone that you hire in a Chapter 12 case has to be approved by the bankruptcy judge. So if you want to hire someone like Norm, a farm and ranch consultant, then Norm obviously has been approved in many cases, and he's well respected. But if you're going to hire somebody from your local community that's never stepped foot into the bankruptcy arena, that person may be objections to his employment. It may be harder to get that person approved because he doesn't have the experience. He or she doesn't have the experience to do that work. And it's this, the attorney has to be approved, the farm consultant has to be approved, the appraiser, if you have an appraisal done during the case, that person needs to be approved. If you hire a CPA, which sometimes is necessary, that person needs to be approved by the court.
Well, thank you for that explanation. That helps clear up some of how the behind-the-scenes stuff works. Here's another detailed question someone sent in, is wondering how the terms of the debt repayment are actually determined, both the term and interest rate, as they are set by the court. How is that worked out?
Well, in most cases, it's been my experience, if we're talking about real estate debt, we're probably talking, the 20-year M period. And certainly, as Ken mentioned earlier, the market rate for interest would be the appropriate interest rate to apply. You're not going to get much of a break on interest rates from the bankruptcy court, because most of the judges are well aware of what market rates are. I have seen some situations to help cash flows on reorganization plans, where possibly on livestock or machinery notes, where the bank has agreed to maybe am it over a longer period of time. For example, one case I worked on machinery, the bank agreed to am the note over over 7 years with a balloon in 5 years, which gave them a little bit of a break in terms of their payments on an annual basis on that. I've seen it as high as 10 years with a balloon in 7. But I would caution people that at the end of 7 years or 5 years, whenever that balloon payment comes due and payable, can create some real financial problems. And we saw that in the 80s, where a lot of people were buying homes with really high interest rates with balloon payments in 10 years or 15 years, and ended up consequently losing those properties, because basically at that point in time, the note becomes due and payable unless you have identified a new lender that to refinance it, or the existing lender has agreed to refinance it. It can create some problems, but nevertheless, it does provide some ease in terms of maybe possibly reducing your payments on whatever period of time you're amortizing it over. At least reduces the amount of payment on an annual basis, hopefully.
Okay, here's kind of a follow-up on that in some ways. Person's wondering if they're having to make a choice or look at the trade-off between the loan value itself and more affordable terms as the workout's being put together, how should the capital gains tax considerations play into that decision? I mean, how should a person look at the capital gains taxes and the implication that it may have both for the loan value and then the terms of the loan itself?
Well, I think you'd have to, of course, the capital gains tax considerations would only apply in where you actually are selling assets during the Chapter 12. But if that's the case, then you know that would be something you'd do on a case-by-case basis. You just have to look at the specific numbers for that situation. And, you know, that's normally going to mean you're going to need to get with your accountant, find out what the basis is in the assets, do the tax, the math on the tax part of it, and then look at that versus what the alternatives are. I don't think you can make a generalization about that. I think it just, every case is going to be different.
If I can just expand on it, I think, there's some other options under the, the title in lieu of foreclosure kind of things, where the seller actually might be faced with some significant capital gains tax, where he turns the title over or she turns the title over in lieu of foreclosure proceedings, whereas the 12 provides you with some a little bit different tax treatment, which could protect you in terms of your capital gains tax that may be facing your business. So those are things that you need to discuss with either your farm consultant or with your farm accountant or whoever you're working with prior to, and the attorney, obviously, before you file a Chapter 12 or a Chapter 11, what those consequences might be.
Okay. And Norm, I think you touched on this earlier. I mean, you just now mentioned it again about the importance of that outside expert or farm management person that a person facing reorganization or bankruptcy likely needs to get in onto their team. Have you or either one of you have any recommendations on how a person would go about contacting someone in their state for assistance in that area, either if they have to provide testimony or just provide backstop or assistance in putting the figures together as part of the workout plan?
Well, you know, there's a number of considerations, I think, aside from the qualifications, but in some states, for example, I'll be very honest about my position here. I'm a full professor, so I'm allowed to do some consulting one day a week. So I can do this on a consulting basis. If I were 100% extension, I would not be able to do that. Not that I get paid for all of the Chapter 12s I've done. But finding an expert can be kind of difficult, primarily because people are really nervous about going in a courtroom and testifying and being qualified, because many cases it's not the most rewarding experience you want to go through. But I've always been of the opinion, I grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, and I feel like it's my obligation to help as many farmers and ranchers as I can in the state of Colorado. I've also worked in Wyoming and Nebraska and helping farmers as well. But certainly the first place I would start is with a land grant institution and a person such as yourself, John, who is a farm management specialist. Possibly those individuals would have some people that they would recommend the farmer, rancher, or dairy person, whatever, get in touch with.
Okay. Well, thank you for that suggestion. There's another question that's come in here. I was wondering whether, in your guys' opinion, if the limited capacity of the courts at present to process a bankruptcy proceedings is currently putting any kind of pressure on creditors to settle with their debtors outside of the bankruptcy courtroom.
Well, I would say that the answer to that is probably yes, and it's been that way for a long time. The bankruptcy judges are very busy, and as I said earlier, they will often suggest strongly that all the attorneys get together and try to hammer out a negotiated agreement on each loan. This is something that's just, it's almost, the judges, it's almost to the point where they don't even need to say that because everyone understands it. It's a win-win if you can go in to the judge at the final confirmation hearing and say, "Judge, we've ironed out our differences, we've reached agreements with all the different creditors, we've got a what we call a consensual plan," which means everyone has consented to it. I think there is pressure on all the different players to try and negotiate out an agreement. Now, does that mean that in every case it works that way? No. We've had cases where we were able to negotiate, say, with John Deere on their payments. We were able to negotiate with the local operating lender. We were able to negotiate with, you know, most of the creditors. But we have one or two creditors that just, you know, they just will not, we cannot reach an agreement with them. And in those cases, then we do have to have a confirmation hearing. And the judge, the judges usually are appreciative that you've made as much progress as you have. In other words, you're just not throwing the whole thing in his lap. But in some cases, you do go to the judge and say, "Judge, we just can't work this out with this this one particular lender. And so we need to have a hearing just to address this lender's disputes." And so that's, you know, that does come up sometimes.
Right. And you have to, the audience has to realize that these federal bankruptcy judges are dealing with, you know, not just 12s, but 7s, 11s, and 13s as well. So I remember very distinctly in Denver when they filed the new version of the, you know, made Chapter 12 a permanent chapter in the bankruptcy code, and they had revisited Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 and had made some changes. The last month in October of 06, I think there was something like 70,000 Chapter 7s and 13s filed in the district court, or the federal district court in Denver. So they are very busy, the judges. One other comment that I think probably is appropriate is that the trustee, the bankruptcy trustee, can also file objections. So you know, in addition to working through the bankruptcy with the various creditors, also the trustee has to approve the plan as well, because he's the one that's going to be dispersing the funds. So that's another little aspect to consider.
Okay, well, thank you both for taking so many questions. I think we've pretty well worked through them all now, and appreciate very much your well-reasoned and thought-out answers. It's explained a number of things for me, and I'm sure has helped clarify a number of points for the audience as well. I really want to thank you both again for taking the time to be with us today. I'm confident that many of our participants have actually gained a number of insights from your wealth of experience and participation in bankruptcies over so many years. As we move to wrap up today's program, I'd like to remind everyone about the recordings of both the audio MP3 files and the video downloads of our previous programs that are available on our website. We invite you to consider participating in one or more of our upcoming webinars that you can see scheduled on the website there at Ag in Uncertain Times. As mentioned earlier, the recordings and other information are available on this website, and we will provide some additional instructions here at the end in just a second, how to get to that site and how to access the material. If you're interested in today's presentation slides, they are also available at that site for download and your later reading. We'd like to particularly encourage you to consider sitting in on tomorrow's presentation by Ruth Hambleton and Dr. Bob Fetch, who will be offering additional tools and materials for, again, helping farm families facing these difficult times we're in today. Coming up in November, we'll be hosting a number of presenters with tools and techniques for operating in risky environments, beginning on the 4th of November. It might be worth noting that all of our webinars are actually slated to begin at the same time, which is 9 Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, and 12 noon Eastern. We should also mention that we'd like to hear from you if you have suggestions for other topics or presentations that you would like to see offered in the future. You can either get that to us by making your suggestion through the chat pod there on the screen, or by sending an email to westrme@wsu.edu. As we've mentioned as we've gone along today, that a number of different URLs and websites may be of interest to you to pursue, and in order to provide you with a single reference for all of those pieces of information, we've compiled a PDF file which you may now download via this file share pod I've just put up on the screen. To do that, you click on the file name you see listed there in the pod, and then click on the Save to My Computer button at the bottom to download that file to your own desktop. So let me just close by again extending our thanks to both of today's presenters for their first-class presentation on bankruptcy. And thanks also to our Ag and Uncertain Times team and their sponsoring institutions for making this series possible. We'd also very much like to thank all the participants in today's webinar. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work with farm families, and we hope to see you again on one of our upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincerest hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. For Ag in Uncertain Times, I'm John Hewlett.